Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and you're listening to All Ball, the All Basketball Podcast. We drop one once a week, and this week our guest is Fran McCaffrey. Coach McCaffrey, or Franny, as most of you know him if you're in the basketball industry, recruited me to go to Notre Dame. I know probably more about his story, about how he met his wife, Margaret, about his boys. Of course, everybody knows some of the stories of him bringing up two boys. Than maybe anybody in college basketball. He's a dear, dear friend, and I've told him before, and if you listen to his podcast, we talk about real things. I personally think I'm the reason that they got fired at Notre Dame. You know, when I was a freshman, we had another high school senior, David Lalazarian, who I played with in high school. He was coming in the next year. He did play 1 year at Notre Dame before transferring to Pepperdine. We had Pat Garrity. I felt like we were, even though we struggled our first year in the Big East, we were close. And then, you know, when I get in trouble and leave and they give the scholarship to Jimmy Dillon, no disrespect to Jimmy Dillon, Admiral White took over as point guard, set you back in terms of your plan. More than anything, it didn't cast a great shadow on Notre Dame. So even though they got Todd Murphy and they were better, they weren't good enough to stay employed. And he ultimately left and got the UNC Greensboro job. But I think the world of him as a coach, as a person, and as a recruiter, and it's going to be great for you to hear me catching up with him. Some of the look back, some of the look at right now at his Iowa club, who just survived Northwestern at home in an unbelievable win. I want to give you a couple thoughts on Duke, who I saw in person, a 23-point comeback on the road at Louisville. Actually, it's more kind of about Louisville, right? Louisville violated so many of the codes of ethics if you have a big lead in trying to close out a game, right? They're up 23, up 20. They're taking quick, long shots. That's a mistake. They missed three front ends of a 1-1. Oops. They turned the ball over and gave up layups against full court pressure. Can't do it. There was a lack of luck. 2 minutes to go. Christian Cunningham got an offensive rebound, got a defensive rebound when the ball hit off of Zion Williamson. Instead of dribbling up the sideline, he dribbled back where Williamson was laying and slipped on a wet spot. Duke laid the ball in. Instead of having the ball up five and seemingly staving off the comeback, now sends a three-point game, and ultimately they end up losing. They fouled, which allowed Duke to score with the clock stopped. They gave up open three-point shots. You know, make teams take contested twos. Make teams beat you with the clock running. Make your free throws, especially front ends of 1-1s. You know, when Zion Williamson's in foul trouble out with four fouls and you're out a 23-point lead, take the ball to the rim, especially when he comes back in. They didn't do any of these things. And then Duke hits a bunch of shots. I'll give my thoughts on Zion in a second, but as much as Duke was outstanding in how they were flatliners, they didn't overreact to being down 23. If I had to say, did Duke win or Louisville lost because of those things. You cannot miss front ends of 1-1. You cannot give up layups, you know, pick six turnovers. And you cannot shoot quickly and try and go for dagger shots. Just take layups, easy open shots, drag out the shot clock, score at the end of shot clock, get to the foul line, stabilize your defense. They did none of this. All right, let me tell you about what I saw when I watched Zion Williamson in person. So, look, Zion is probably, I think he's measured out in bare feet, below 6 foot six, and that looked about how tall he was. And he's wide, and he, once he kind of gets going, is crazy athletic. Laterally, pretty good as well. Obviously, vertically. Tries to block every shot, tries to run through every pass. Doesn't always have the best footwork in trying to run through passes in terms of using his top foot. Sometimes he gets lazy. And look, that's how Duke plays. Duke's trying to steal every pass. And just overplay. And Louisville did a great job up until they pressed and zoned and choked and Louisville choked. But I want to make sure that you don't in your mind mischaracterize him. He's not LeBron. He's not Ben Simmons. He's not a true ball handler, even though he can handle the ball. His skill defensively will be a more athletic version of Draymond Green in that he can guard 1 through 5. He can switch on the ball screens. He can guard bigs. He's obviously a crazy weak side shot blocker with his jumping ability, long arms, and timing. And he's big, strong, and he's pretty tough, and he competes. So I think he's a power forward that becomes a small ball five, and he can also bring the ball up the court, a lot like Draymond. Vertically, there's some Blake Griffin to him. There's a little bit of Lamar Odom to him, you know, as kind of a stretch four with kind of a, he doesn't have a hitch. It's just not a great looking shot from the perimeter, but that can be helped. He's only taken one pull-up jump shot all year. Obviously, there's room, massive room for development in terms of his skill. He does go mostly left, and sometimes when he can't dunk, struggles finishing going to his right. Again, all can be worked on. But I think the big thing for Zion is, last year when people saw him, they're like, not in great shape, doesn't always play hard, and how skilled is he? Now you see him and his skills improved. He's in better shape and he plays hard a good portion, if not most of the time. And if you watch Duke, he's really their leader. RJ Barrett's their best player right now and the one guy who they play through more than anybody. But they look, Zion brings their energy. Zion is a, what's it, Eric Mangini calls it, a force multiplier. He raises up the intensity of shoot around, of warmups, and obviously of the games. And at the end of that game, he wanted to take over. So coming into the season, I thought R.J. Barrett was, without question, the number one pick. R.J.'s shot does look a bit mechanical. And if he doesn't have the ball in his hands, there's not a lot that he does offensively. Defensively, he's better than I thought in terms of being active, and he did compete. And I like Cam Reddish. And I think Cam's going to be a guy who plays in the NBA for 15 years and be a scorer. But I don't think it's close. I think you take Zion Williamson, number one, and you don't even look back. My concerns with R.J. Barrett, I talked with some NBA scouts, and I posed this to them, and a lot of them nod their heads. Not everybody agrees with it. I think R.J. is really good. I think he's a winner. I think he's a competitor. And I do think he competes at the defensive end. But my question becomes, his jump shot is quite mechanical, and he's going to have to develop a lot more fluidity in it, considering how much he wants to dominate the basketball and how people are going to make him shoot. But he's got the makings of what could be a great player. My question becomes, this is like the opposite of the Zion Williamson. His role with this team is a lot like his role with most any team he's played on, in that he's the guy. He's the alpha. He's the ball handler. He's the shot maker. He's the creator. He's everything. And if you can't make any shots to keep people honest in the NBA, to make them fight over the screen or to make them challenge you on jump shots, and you're not good enough, then you don't get that role. And if you don't get that role, can he actually succeed? I don't have an answer for that, but I'm fascinated to learn it. Let me quickly turn to the NBA. One thing I know to be true, and one thing that I believe to be true, and it's backed up by Danny Ainge. First, the thing I know to be true. There's been a lot of talk over the last week and a half or so leading up into the All-Star break over the Lakers and what happened with the New Orleans Pelicans. But you're going to have to open up your mind to the understanding that the Pelicans, who basically through Brian Windhorst admitted they were tweaking the Lakers, tried to poison the well so badly. I was told that the proposed trades that have been out there, where the Lakers were willing to give up Zubac, who's no longer there, 21 years old, Brandon Ingram, Kyle Kuzma, Josh Hart, Lonzo Ball, and draft picks, and cap relief, we're not close to what the Lakers actually offered, which would make a lot more sense. Whether it was LeBron James's team hitting full panic mode, thinking they might not get another player, or the New Orleans Pelicans tweaking the Lakers by leaking that information to the media, I was told no such trade offer was ever made, and that this was simply a case of the Pelicans trying to poison the well. And I wonder, like, think about it. If you're the Knicks and you land Zion, are you really going to give up on Zion for Anthony Davis? Right? It is New York City. It is about drawing a crowd, and I think you can win big with Zion. And whether you get Kemba Walker or you get Kyrie Irving and you get Kevin Durant, like, aren't you going to want a guy who can guard multiple positions? I guess you get that with Anthony Davis, but you're going to have to pay Anthony Davis in his second year if he stays a ridiculous sum of money, as opposed to Zion playing on a rookie deal. It's not a locked up cinch the Knicks have much to give in return, let alone the Knicks are going to want to trade that draft pick. The same can be said for the Boston Celtics. The Celtics have the, well, does Anthony Davis really want to be here? They're going to try and re-sign Kyrie Irving. And if Kyrie Irving doesn't re-sign, why would they trade Jason Tatum? For Anthony Davis? That doesn't make any sense considering the construct of their lineup. So many things have to go right for the Pelicans to get a better offer than whatever the offer was for the Lakers. Meanwhile, the Lakers smartly pulled out. Now, did they pull out in time to save their season? We'll find out after the All-Star break. Luke's going to remain as their coach. And before LeBron got hurt, they were top seven in all defensive categories. It's really important to note that playing with LeBron and playing without LeBron are two completely different ways of playing basketball. And it takes players a while to learn how to play with him. Then he goes out for 17 games, comes back for one, sits another one. And you have to learn how to play without him after learning how to play with him. I think that's as much of the cause for the uneven season in LA as it is the fact that, you know, coaching or luck or some, you know, brain flatulence like that of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. Let's catch up with Coach McCaffrey. And Franny, I want to get to your playing career, getting into coaching, and what led you to ultimately leave Siena and go to Iowa in a moment. But kind of give me the state of the Hawkeyes. Last time we saw you, you went on an incredible shot by Bohannon. You guys won a couple in a row. It feels like the team seems to have figured out who they are and what you want them to be. But again, these are outside perspectives. If you were going to give a state of the Hawkeyes address, how would it start?
Doug, I would tell you this. This team is a connected group. And you know what that means. You know, whether we're coming down in transition, whether we're running motion, whether we're running sets, you know, we're executing. We've got willing passers. We've got willing screeners. Defensively is where it really manifests itself. And last year, I would tell you, we were not a connected group defensively. Whether we were changing defenses or we stuck with one, you know, it always seemed like there was a breakdown somewhere. You know, we'd play hard for, you know, 22 seconds and give up an easy shot, you know, 3 seconds on a shot clock. We're rebounding better. But I think at the end of the day, we're a little tougher than we were, you know, and what was interesting was 2 years ago, a lot of the same core guys are with us and they were tougher then, but we had still had Peter Jock, who led the league in scoring. So that was a big difference, in that team versus the team from last year. So this team, I think, has a lot more weapons. So for example, you know, we survived about a 3.5 to 4 week stretch without Garza. MVP of the 2K Classic in New York, had a 5-game stretch where he's averaging over 20 and then gets in foul trouble against Indiana and doesn't score against Northwestern, yet we still win. You know, Cook, his numbers have been phenomenal, but we beat Indiana on the road. I think he had 7 or 9. We're still able to win. That wouldn't have happened a year ago. So there's various people that are stepping up. Isaiah Moss had a 5-game stretch where he was absolutely phenomenal and then didn't score for 2 straight games. Well, then, okay, Bohannon steps up, Joe Wieskamp steps up, Connor McCaffrey steps up, and so did Macy Daly. So that we just seem to have more guys ready to go and when we need them, and everybody supports each other. You can see that on the bench. The guys that were out of the game with Bohannon at that shot, we're just as happy as the guys that were on the floor.
There's actually a bunch I want to dig in on that. How did you kind of rebuild the culture to one of toughness, right? Because anybody who knows you and frankly knows Margaret, your wife, I mean, she was an incredibly tough basketball player. She's a tough cookie. You growing up in Philly, your entire coaching career, your teams kind of exuded toughness. But yeah, last year it wasn't there. I would offer up this. I think some of it's probably last year, and I want to know some of the things that you've done, but and some of it's the personnel that you have and guys figuring out. I also think that losing those two games early in the Big Ten, while coaches hate playing those early Big Ten games traditionally, I kind of felt like it helped you center your guys. And, you know, that early season success that you had, you're like, hey, look, that's not the Big Ten. Michigan State, when they hammered you guys, it seemed to help get some of your messages across. Give me the reality of how you were able to kind of reestablish your program as one that does play defense, that does do the little things to win these games.
Well, you're 100% right, Doug. I mean, if you're in this business, you're a competitive individual. And I've been at various places, both as an assistant and as a head coach. And there's a level of toughness that's required. And I think a lot of times when you hear that word, you're thinking physical toughness. And you were a great example of that. Yeah, you were a pretty tough guy. But what you were was a guy who understood the game to a whole nother level. And you knew what was necessary in this game. Okay, we're playing a team that is changing defenses. We're playing a team that's half-court man-to-man is going to be trying to be physical with you. Can we score in transition in this game? Do we have to execute our set plays in this game? Coming down the stretch, time and score. That's the toughness that we lacked. We weren't able to perform to the level that was required in those situations coming down the stretch in a five-point game. You know, you look at teams, Doug, and one team wins 20, another team loses 20. Well, one team's not great, the other team horrible. They're actually very close. But one team has the ability to win five-point games, the other team doesn't. So you have to, number one, have complete buy-in to, okay, we have to make change. All right, we have to make change collectively. We have to make change individually. And it can't be the head coach pointing at each guy and saying, okay, you have to change. No, we all have to change. Okay, we're all in this together. We win together, we lose together, and we figure it out together. So for me, it was challenge them, hold them accountable, but know that, you know, I have your back, and we're going to get better, we're going to stay the course, and we're going to be better than we were last year. And you're right, Doug. I mean, I think you make a great point. We established ourselves in New York as a team that's clearly better than we were a year before. But how do you survive? You know, Cook didn't play two games. Guards didn't play four games. Bohannon had a few off games earlier in the year. Bohannon's in foul trouble against UConn. You know, Connor plays great. Joe Wieskamp came on the scene and clearly made a difference. Enabled Nicholas Bear to kind of be who he is and be that guy, one of the top six men in the country. So, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to what you said about those early Big Ten games. No, we don't like playing Big Ten games in early December. But the reality is 20 league games helps our conference get more teams in the NCAA tournament. So that's what we're going to do. So rather than complain about it, you better have complete buy-in. And if you get your ears pinned back like we did against Michigan State, okay, where do we go from here? We got a long way to go. You know, one of the things that I think, because we lost to Wisconsin at home and a game we could have won, we lose to Michigan State on the road, and we lose to Purdue on the road. And then, you know, you turn on the radio, you turn on TV, and there's a lot of people panicking. Oh, you can't start 0-3. Well, you know, you sort of can. You have 17 left in the league. Okay, so you can, and we had more games to play other than that. So you can get the ship turned around. But the important thing is to be honest with yourself in assessing what can you do differently and then what can we do differently.
All right, Len, let's go back. I remember of the stories that I remember from people who coached me and you recruited me. My favorite story is the two stories you told me about playing at Wake Forest for Kyle Tacy. The one is you guys had a rule, right, where underneath out of bounds, you're in zone, sideline out of bounds, you're in man. Am I correct in the rule?
You are correct.
Okay, and you're playing at Cameron Indoor Stadium. This is you're a freshman starting at point guard in the ACC, right?
Correct.
And again, tell me if my memory is correct, but the ball goes out of bounds. It's kind of an odd angle, but it was on the sideline, not on the baseline.
Right.
And so you're in man-to-man, and those other four idiots are in zone. And, of course, they throw it in out of bounds play, throw it in for an elbow jump shot, where had you been in a zone, would have been where you were supposed to be as a 6'4" skinny 100-whatever-pound soaking wet freshman out of Philadelphia. And so Kyle Tacy does what all old coaches do. He turns around and whips and throws another guy into the game for you and takes you out and proceeds to berate you. Is that correct?
Correct.
And instead of simply walking and sitting down on the bench, remind me, did you say, what exactly did you say to him?
Well, what I said was, you know, he said, what are you doing? Don't you know we're supposed to be in zone? I said, Coach, the ball went out of bounds on the side. We're supposed to be in man. And he looked at me, and he looked, and so I should have done what you just said. I should have walked to the end of the bench and just sat down he probably would have put me back in the game. Instead, I said, you should have left me in and taken those four guys out. So that virtually assured that I didn't get back in that game, but I didn't. Because, you know, that's not the way you're supposed to talk to your coach. But I was sort of baffled by, like, I'm getting taken out because I'm right. And you know, it was something that I always remembered. I mean, you remember plays like that. It's the first time I ever played at Cameron Indoor. You know what it's like. You've been there.
I've never been there.
Amazing play.
I've never been
well,
there.
Well, I've been to them all. I've been to Allen Fieldhouse. I've been to the Dean Dome. I mean, like, I played in Carmichael Coliseum. You know, I played in Cole Fieldhouse. I mean, you're talking about places that have been, you know, I grew up in the Palestra. I mean, you name it. I've been to Pauley Pavilion. There's no place I haven't been. That's as difficult a place as there is. You know, they're really smart. They kept it small. I mean, it's impossible to get a ticket. The atmosphere is electric every night. You know, we had a chance to win the game. We didn't. We beat them when they came to our place. But, you know, it's something that you remember because it's a coaching thing. If you're going to be a coach and you're going to take a kid out of the game and you're going to jump his case on national television, well, you better be right. And
Connor, you hook your son and he comes out of the game and he mutters something to you, even if he's right, how would you react?
One of the differences, Doug, in those days, you didn't say anything back. See, it's a different world. I encourage dialogue. So I might think that you came down the floor and made a ridiculous decision. Rather than jump you and say, Doug, what is wrong with you? I might say, okay, Doug, what'd you see? Okay, this is what I was thinking.
Fran, hold on. I played for you, okay? And granted, yeah. And I've seen you coach enough. I don't think you would have said, it would have been, what the fuck are you thinking? My first start for Notre Dame, we're playing in Baltimore against Loyola Maryland. Yep. And what was the guy's name? He went on to coach at Michigan. He fell into the Michigan job.
Brian Ellerby.
And Brian Ellerby was going to just press the whole game, right? Which,
yeah, we're playing at the Baltimore Arena.
Yes.
I don't even know if it's still there.
Yeah. So, and as you know, but I don't know if people listen to podcasts know, like I had my flaws as a basketball player, but you were not pressing me. That was just not happening, right? That was a layup.
We would hope they would press us.
Yes. I mean, that's the last. So... Yeah. So we're playing pretty well. It's kind of a scattershot game. And early on in the second half, I'm feeling good about myself because, again, if I get it second pass against the press, it's over. And we're coming down on a 3-on-1. Pat Garrity's on my left and Ryan Hoover's on my right. And I had the ball in my left hand. I cross over to my right hand and kind of throw a spinning behind the back pass, which is kind of like a signature one for me that I almost never airmail. And I was behind Pat because he has deceptive speed. A very, very deceptive speed.
Yeah.
And it hits the priest who was not paying attention.
He was open though.
He was open. He was shot ready as well, which is the most impressive part. And I didn't even run up the court. I did the here it comes. And I go over there and you know McLeod, he didn't really yell and he's apoplectic. He's beside himself. He can't. On the other hand, you stood up. What in the fuck are you, take that shit back to California, was what was uttered. So in other words, I understand that you encourage dialogue now, but let's not kid ourselves. You're not saying, well, Connor, what did you see?
It all depends on the situation. Okay, now you and I have great memories. See, the interesting thing about that game, we had that game won. It started to fall apart.
Yep.
Okay, and I am relying on our point guard, dude, just get us home, okay? And I was stunned that you actually threw that pass in that situation. And I knew that I could challenge you in a way that was very direct because of the relationship that we had. And you're right, I will do that at times, but it's got to be the appropriate time. It can't be every time you turn the ball over, every time you miss a shot, every time you miss a guy who's open. You know, I'm going to question, why didn't you drive it? Why didn't you shoot it? Why didn't you pass it? What are you thinking? It's got to be you trusting your own judgment and your own talent to go make plays. But in that situation, I was perplexed that you made that play under those circumstances, because it was so out of character for you. And I think at the end of the day, you were just trying to have some fun. Like, coach, we got this. But it was like we were up 21, and all of a sudden we're up 9, and we need to finish this fast break to go back up 11 because we're on the road. We just got to get out of here with a W. We can't lose to Loyola. And you almost killed the priest.
This is what I've always wondered. I was terrible, as you know, my first couple weeks in practice. You know, I was just beside myself. I didn't understand why I was so bad.
By the way, you weren't terrible. You weren't as good as you should have been, but you weren't terrible.
I just felt like I was running.
You were beneath your own standards, is what you were.
Well, but we were running like a true motion offense. Most of our practice was in the half court, which takes away like 75% of my powers, right?
We're not
running organized break. There's not any screen roll was to my right hand instead of to my left hand, which is where I like to go. Like everything, I felt like I was completely lost. Anyway, somehow I managed to sneak into games early in the game, and I'd like to think it wasn't just because I was promised, you know, I'd get an opportunity to start. How do you know? And you've done this for a long time. Some guys just are not going to look the same in a game as in practice. How do you know who's going to be a gamer and who's going to be practice? Who just looks good in practice? What's the secret to that?
Well, there's a couple things. Number one, I knew you pretty well. Okay, I watched you in AAU. I watched you for your high school team. I watched you grow up. I remember you were a little sophomore. Okay, so I kind of knew your backbone. All right. So typically, you have an idea in your head. This guy is going to be fine when the TV lights come on. You know, some guys can play at 3 o'clock, and some guys can play at 7 o'clock. And some guys, you know, they just the TV lights come on, and they're not the same person. You know, we've all seen them, we've all coached them. So the critical thing is to have an idea, number one, of what you think is going to happen, but then number two, be confident enough in who you recruited to give them the opportunity to play when the TV lights come on. You know. Don't have them sit there the whole year and don't give them a chance. You got to give them a chance because they might surprise you. They might develop. You know, some guys take a little longer, like you said. Okay, I was a little uncomfortable in the motion scheme. All right, well, that's a fairly legitimate, you know, I wouldn't say excuse, but all right, we got to give you time. Okay. You know, Troy Murphy had the same problem, by the way. I remember him saying, like, he was like, what do I do now? And eventually, like, we would say, well, you could do this, but you could do that, you could do this. And that, a lot of guys don't like that. It's, tell me where to go, tell me where to line up. So finally, Troy, one day, he had, like, this light bulb go off moment. He turned to me and said, so basically what you mean is, just go score. Like, yeah, just go score. Now, maybe you screen and slip. Maybe you get a screen. Maybe your guy turns his head and you basket cut. But I want you to score. We'll get people to screen for you. Now, a lot of times, the screener is the guy who's more open. I mean, no better example than the play we ran to win the game against Northwestern. Bohannon said a screen popped out. He's open. He hits the three. Okay? So, you know, we try to get Troy to understand, okay, you're going to have to do some screening for yourself. But go get buckets. Where's the ball? Where's my man? Are they in the gaps? Is the X on the O? And trust what your two eyeballs are seeing. And you had that ability. He had that ability. Sometimes it takes a little longer, that's all.
Okay, for people who don't know, you got into coaching at like right out of school. You transferred to Penn.
Correct.
You were sitting out during the Final Four. Did you get to travel to Utah during the Final Four?
I did, but not with the team. I traveled with actually my roommate at the time was Tommy Massimino, Rolly Massimino's son. Still great friends till this day. And what they did was they chartered a plane for the students. It was like 300 students. And we got on that plane. And so we were at the game, at both games, because in those days, even though we lost to Michigan State, they had a consolation game, played DePaul. So I was out there, and I was at the hotel, but I wasn't technically with the team and stuff like that. So it was a little bit different. But being associated with that team, Doug, was amazing for me because it was the epitome of what great culture is. We always talk about the culture in your program. That team had winning culture. They had senior leadership. They had hard workers. They had unselfish players. We had a great coaching staff. Bob Weinhauer was the head coach. Bob Stack was the assistant. Dennis Jackson, we had a great staff. And for me to be associated with having transferred, you kind of go sign with an ACC school. Things don't work out. You transfer. You're with a team that goes to the Final Four. Okay, now I know how you have to act, how you have to prepare, how you have to compete to be a winning team on a national level. It was very, very beneficial to me, clearly down the road even as a head coach.
You get done at Penn in, what was it, 82?
Correct.
Why'd you go, like, you graduate from Penn. Why go into coaching?
You know what happens, Doug, is you're involved with the game. I mean, I have to, you know, I feel like you and I grew up similarly in the sense that, you know, your dad put a ball in your hand when you were a little baby, and you know, that's what we did for fun. We played and we went to games. On Friday night we went to high school games. On Saturday night we went to college games. I mean, that's what we did. So all of a sudden, you know, your career comes to a screeching halt. I'm not going to play in the NBA. All right. Well, you got to make a decision. You want to go work on Wall Street? I mean, do you want to go to graduate school? You want to go to law school? I mean, where do you want to go with your life? I wasn't ready to walk away from the game. Now, sometimes you don't have an opportunity to stay in the game the way that you want to. But in those days, in the Ivy League, they had a third spot that was essentially a volunteer spot. So I got a part-time job on campus. We had a JV program. So I was the head coach of the JV program, which they don't even have anymore, which was a great experience. I was the third assistant on the varsity team, and Craig Littlepage was the head coach, and Tommy Schneider, and Dennis Jackson still. No, Dennis was gone. But anyway, I learned a lot from Craig. So I learned some stuff from my experiences at Wake. Then I played for Coach Weinhauer, go to the Final Four. We went to the tournament a bunch of times after that. Now I'm working for Craig Littlepage, and everybody's different. And I think that's the value of, you know, you think about it, I'm still a relatively young guy. I'm a head coach on the JV, so I can try my own stuff, but I'm working with people that have great experience. I mean, you know, you look at Bob Weinhauer, where he was on the Chuck Daly tree, you know, coach of Dream Team 1, Hall of Famer. And Craig Littlepage worked for Terry Holland, and he played for Dick Harter, who was a great coach in his own right at Penn and Oregon and in the pros for all those years. So I'm being exposed to a lot of valuable ideas and information while at the same time being able to make some of my own decisions. So I was really fortunate to have been exposed to all that at a young age.
And then you were, I don't know, like 26 years old, you became a head coach at Lehigh. Was that right?
Correct. You know, what happened was Tommy Schneider was our top assistant. He gets the Lehigh job. He said, come on up with me, help me build this thing. I said, boy, that'd be great. I'd love to. And I went up there because I was going to earn my master's degree. And it's funny because at the time I made a very unique decision because my coach, Bob Weinhauer, took the job at Arizona State. And his assistants were Doug Collins and Henry Bibby. And he called and said, you know, why don't you come out here and be our GA? And Tommy Schneider says, you know, essentially be my GA. So I chose to go to Lehigh rather than Arizona State. And the reason I did that was because I wanted to get a valuable – I felt like if I was a GA at Arizona State at that time, I really wasn't going to be a student. It was more of a way to be a full-time coach, and that would have been great, except I wanted to get a master's. I felt like if I make a decision to make a career change, I need to have an advanced degree. Even though I had an undergraduate degree from the Wharton School, I wanted an advanced degree. And I wanted to have some flexibility because maybe I want to stay in athletics, go into administration perhaps. So I earned a master's degree in education, focusing on higher ed, which was really valuable for me having remained in higher education all these years. Mm-hmm. And then what happened was we were there for 2 years, and Tommy got Craig Littlepage got the Rutgers job, Tommy got the Penn job, and they promoted me at age 26. So I was a head coach at 26 and always thankful for that opportunity from Lehigh University.
All right, you get the job at 26 years old. What do? You get your first head coaching job. You've been around sports. It's like an hour or a little more than an hour outside of Philly. So you have that, back then they were the Engineers before the Mountain Hawks, right? But it's a school of really good academic repute, which you'd been at Wake, you'd been at Penn, so you knew the gyms you were supposed to be into. But to be a head coach that young, what was it like? What do you remember about your first experiences?
It was challenging, and it was exciting, but it was also probably a little nerve-wracking. You know, all of a sudden, you're an assistant, and all of a sudden, what's the big difference? We all know it. You go from making suggestions to making decisions. Timeout, those players are looking at you. You come down to recruiting these three guys for one spot. Who do you want? Okay, let's make this the right call. Let's get the right guy. And so you're also the face of the program. So you're speaking to alumni groups, and you're handling the media. And I remember, it's funny you should ask that question, because ironically, we were in a Manna-Hawkeye Classic at the University of Iowa my first year at Lehigh. So I get the job. We're scheduled to play University of Iowa in about 6 weeks. So I get a call from Jerry Strom, who's the director of ops at the time. He says, hey, what's your topic? I'm like, topic for what? He goes, well, we have a coaching clinic. When you come out here to play in the tournament, you're going to speak at our coaching clinic. There's going to be 1,300 coaches there. I've never spoken at a coaching clinic before. So I said, I'm going to get back to you on that. I got to think about what I want to talk about. So I called him back and did it. I walk in and said, all of a sudden, I'm in an overhead projector speaking to 1,300 high school coaches. A lot of them are in their 50s and 60s. I'm 26 years old. But I remember I coached against George Raveling. And I remember when I also coached against, I'm trying to remember who was, I think it might have been Rick Majerus. He was at Ball State at the time.
Wow, yeah.
I think, yeah. So, I mean, Doug, it goes fast. All of a sudden, you think it looks. It seems like it was yesterday. It was 1985.
Fran McCaffrey joining me here on the All Ball Podcast. Then you made a decision, which I've seen a couple people do since. Right? I'm thinking of what Chris did when he left Gardner Webb and he went to Butler to become an assistant coach because you felt like you had to have, what, high major experience to get a high major job? Like, why leave the Lehigh job to go work for Digger at Notre Dame?
Well, we go to the tournament in 88 and had a great team. And I interviewed for two positions that year. One was the University of Massachusetts when John Calipari was hired. The other was SMU when John Shumate was hired. And what I tried to do was, since I didn't get either position, is to gain some feedback on, okay, why not me? Why did you hire somebody else? Mm-hmm. Now, I had great respect for. I knew Calipari really well. We were good friends from our days at Five Star. So it's like, all right, we didn't pick you. So these are the reasons why. I said, I want you to tell me the truth. Well, we didn't feel like you could recruit on a national level. You've done a good job recruiting. You had a really good team. You coached them up. We played the number one team in the NCAA tournament that year right down to the wire. It looks like you, from a technical standpoint, know what you're doing, but you didn't ever recruit anybody basically outside of Pennsylvania and New Jersey, which was true. It was valid. So you can get angry and, you people don't know what you're doing, or you can say, you know what? All right, I somehow have to complete the picture here. I have to expand and maybe leave the comfort zone of being a head coach. And I just bought a home, and now I've got to sell it, all that kind of stuff. The easy thing would have been to stay, but Shumate got the SMU job. He was the assistant at Notre Dame, so I called Digger. I said, Coach, I'd like to come work for you. And he was surprised. like that a head coach would want to do that. And he was very candid. He just said, hey, I got two people in mind. I'm going to offer it to them. I might call you, but I might not.
Wait, you had just taken Lehigh to the NCAA tournament at like 28 years old, and he wasn't you weren't his first choice.
Was not his first choice, and he told me he says I'm going to offer the job to Don Casey and Craig Littlepage, who Casey had been a coach at Temple and was coach of the Clippers, and Craig Littlepage, was a coach at Rutgers, coach at Penn, assistant at Virginia. I mean, I knew both of them. Craig gave me my first job. So I was like, you know what, coach? If you get Craig Littlepage or Don Casey, I mean, you've hit not a home run, you've hit a grand slam. So I get it. And he called me about 6 weeks later and said, they turned it down. They didn't want to do it. Come on out for an interview. And when I went out there, I figured out that Digger doesn't do interviews. It's kind of like I already decided who I wanted. Like he wanted those two guys. They said no, and then he was like, okay, I'm going to go to my next guy. And he said, we had lunch. We talked a little bit, but it wasn't like, here's let's X and O, let's talk this thing. It was like, no, this is a guy I want, and wanted to make sure I got along with the other assistants. Matty Kilcullen I'd known for years. Jeff Nix and I are, best friends till this day, and very thankful for the opportunity to coach at Notre Dame that Digger gave me.
What was Digger really like? I mean, I do think that there is a generation of people who don't understand. All they know is they beat UCLA, and they know a little bit about the highlighters and that he was on ESPN for a long time. But they don't know, they had a remarkable run of success there. Granted, it was a different era when there was only, one game a week on TV, and Notre Dame was usually one of those teams. But as far as a coach, as a guy to work for, what was he like?
Well, he was challenging to work for because he was incredibly demanding. But he would do anything for you. Has an amazing heart. Never more evident than when my son Patrick got cancer 5 years ago. I mean, the way he reached out to me and the things that he did, speak to exactly who he is as a person. But you're right, Doug. In those days, he was more of a national celebrity. And there were days when I would say to myself, golly, it's tough to be him today. Everybody was pulling at him. He had so many things going, whether it be with TV. I mean, he was friends with George Bush. I mean, you'd be sitting in your office watching film when you'd hear the secretary say, okay, I got the White House on the phone, coach. You're like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. The White House is reaching out to my boss who's in the next office. I remember we went to see President Bush speak on campus, and the speech ended, and there's Secret Service everywhere. It's, come on, let's go. We go in this room, it's the three assistant coaches, Digger, the president and the vice president, and the president of the United States. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. But he was tough on you, but he'd look out for you. He would try to take care of you, and he would help you. He helped a number of coaches in their coaching career advance. But the technical side, I mean, he was really good. Like, he could break a film down extremely well, and I remember a lot of film sessions with him which were challenging because he's challenging you while you're watching it. Like, if it was your scout, boy, you better be on your toes.
Yeah, you told me the story about the Indiana game, right? They only ran 1 ounce.
I lost 13 pounds.
Wait, you lost 13 pounds?
Getting ready for that game. 13 pounds. Yeah, I never watched so much tape on one team. I think I watched 37 tapes. And he would say, okay, what did they do 3 years ago when we were down there? So you had better watch that game from 3 years ago.
The crazy thing about Indiana is they don't actually do anything, right? They I mean, there's no, like, it wasn't called plays. They basically ran a couple different kinds of motion.
They just
ran
motion and played man-to-man. And occasionally he would call triangle and they would go two out, three in. That was it.
Yeah, yeah.
But they would carve you up, with flare screens. And that was always an interesting game. It was my first scout, literally my first scout. And we win the game. Joe Frederick hit a huge shot at the end of the game to win it for us. And ironically, now his nephew, C.J. Frederick, plays for us here in Iowa.
Wow. Okay. So then obviously then John McLeod comes in and you're one of the people, my brother had this when he went to work for Ben Braun. Ben Braun gets fired 7 months in and he ends up being the only guy that Mike Montgomery ended up keeping. Why'd you stay when John McLeod came in as the head coach?
Well, I wanted to stay, number one. I wanted the opportunity to work for Coach McLeod. His reputation was impeccable, but I didn't know him. And so Matty Kilcullen got the Jacksonville head coaching job, so Jeff Nix and I were the only two that were left. And we both wanted to stay with Coach, so we didn't know if he would do that. He offered the positions to Jeff Van Gundy and the other assistant at the time, former NBA player, who was it Garfield Hurd?
We'll go with
Garfield Hurd played for him. I'm trying to remember whoever was on his staff with the Knicks. Okay, I don't think it was Garfield Hurd. But anyway, he offered the job to them. Those guys stayed in the pros and had very successful careers in the pros, both of them. And they were player. You know, the one was a player, the other one was Jeff Van Gundy, who'd been in a while. So it was interesting, Doug, because he just allowed us for 3 weeks. He came to work, we came to work. And I was going to say, Coach, you know, we've got a recruiting class. We got to stay in touch with those guys. Maybe we got to go see them. These are our top recruits. Let's get on the phone with them. And one night he says, hey, let's go watch the NBA playoffs. So we met and we talked recruiting. And so what he was doing was trying to get to know us, and he was watching us work. And I would show him tape on, this is a guy I really like, I think we should get him. But if we're going to do it, we got to get you on the phone with him and his dad, his mom, his coach, AAU coach, et cetera. And so I was just trying to point him in the right direction so that we would kind of hit the ground running, as they say. And after about 3 weeks, he brought both of us in and said, hey, look, I've been watching you guys. I like how you work. I'd like for you to stay and work for him. He said, Coach, we want to work for you. And, you know, I just loved the guy and really enjoyed the opportunity and learned a tremendous amount from him.
Then you get the job, like right as he got fired at Notre Dame, you get the job at Greensboro. What was that like to you? You know, you're on the rise. You're at Lehigh. You go to Notre Dame with the thoughts of, all right, in order to break through the high major level, I need some time here. And then you're back at kind of at Greensboro. What was that experience like?
Well, it was exhilarating because I was back to being a head coach. I had a great boss in Nelson Bob. We had an up-and-coming program, and it was a different part of the country. Margaret and I moved. Connor was a baby. We moved, you know, down south and really enjoyed my 6 years there. You're back to calling the shots, okay? And I think what I was thankful for the opportunity rather than, boy, I could have been the coach at such and such. I mean, think about how many coaches you know, all of whom can say that. You know, I thought I'd be at this level at this time. There's no blueprint for that. You just got to keep grinding. And you know, I was just thankful for that chance, and I was prepared to be there for the rest of my career if that's the way it was going to be. And luckily I had a chance 6 years later to go to Siena. And that was a great opportunity as well. I'm very thankful for John Dargenio to give me a shot.
You guys had it rolling at Siena. I mean, really rolling, Sweet 16 rolling. And it's kind of a special place there. I mean, the Capital District, not just the rivalry with Albany, but the idea that you know, important people really pay attention. And you know, I've heard stories of, you know, there's a group of guys that they come to every practice and they kind of report back to the rest of the boosters. Siena obviously hasn't been the same since you left, but they've had some incredible rises and obviously some falls. Well, that job felt like it prepared you for Iowa. I don't know, to me, like just because of the importance of that job in that area. Whereas, you know, University of Iowa, that's the biggest job in that state, no matter how good Iowa Staters or Northern was for a while. What's unique about the Siena job that's allowed it to, one, be successful, but also, two, one that's really challenging?
I think that's a great point, Doug. And it is all of what you said for this reason. It has its own identity in the Capital District. The Capital District is equidistant from Boston and New York, but far enough away from both to have its own identity. We have our own, had our own TV stations, our own arena. So the people that lived there had been Siena basketball fans since the 50s. They had the Albany Patroons, all right? So that was the old CBA. Phil Jackson coached there. George Carl coached there. So this is a basketball community. High school basketball was really good there. And so what happens is you had all the TV stations and all the print media cover your team, you know, like you're the New England Patriots. So that's what you're talking about in terms of the preparation for being a BCS coach. I don't know that there's a better, you know, place to start, because you get a chance to coach in a big-time arena with everybody scrutinizing everything that you're doing. And it was the early stages of the internet, you know, message boards and all that kind of stuff. So it was really a fun place to be. An incredibly fun place to be because of the interest. And you're right, we would have anywhere from 5 to 30 guys come to practice every day. A lot of retired guys that were Siena alums or didn't go to Siena but were Siena basketball fans from when they were kids growing up in the Capital District. And so when you get to this level and now you have that same type of scrutiny, you've already been through it. You know, it's no big deal. You know, you don't take anything personal. You just keep grinding. You know, you got to keep what needs to stay in-house, get your guys focused and take care of your players and make sure that they're doing what they need to be doing and you build it. And to be honest with you, it's one of those places that you really, once you're there, you could stay there because it's a great place to live. There's great people. They're fair with you. They support you. And I signed an 8-year deal right before I left. And really felt like, okay, I want to end up with my children growing up in this town, and this is where we're going to be. It would only be something very special, like a BCS opportunity at a place like Iowa, that would lure me away. And thankfully, Gary Barta gave me that opportunity.
Really quickly, what is that process like? Because you did sign an 8-year deal, and this is something fans are very flippant about. Well, you know, if coaches can leave, then players should be able to leave, and they think of coaches as just chasing paychecks and not having not caring about the relationships they leave behind. About the decision, you know, it's a major decision, and about how you handled it to try and leave on good terms.
Well, first of all, it's really hard. What made it manageable for me was we accomplished a lot in the time that I was there, and the program was in great shape when I left. I had an unbelievable relationship with Father Mullen, who was our president. Matter of fact, he texted me after the Northwestern game. He watched the whole game. And I remember I put my wife on the phone to say goodbye to Father Mullen, and she burst into tears. That's how much, you know, we both loved him. And so it is hard to leave. I would have had a real hard time leaving 2 or 3 years earlier. I couldn't have done it. And sometimes you have to leave when the opportunity presents itself. And I get the way the fans look at it. But there's a couple things, too. You know, sometimes it doesn't go like that, and they're getting rid of you quickly.
Yeah.
You know, so at the end of the day, it's about relationships, but it's also a business. And you have a family. And you have an opportunity professionally. I can't imagine leaving on better terms than I did. I mean, till this day, John and I are really close. Father Mullen and I are close. All my Siena guys, I was on the phone yesterday. Kenny Hasbrook, one of my favorite players I've ever coached. He was a player of the year. Hit the 3 out of the corner when we beat Ohio State. His dad passed away yesterday. So I'm on the phone with him, telling him how much I love him and hope he's doing okay, and talk to him about his mom and his sister. So those relationships don't end. But sometimes, you know, you have an opportunity. And then there's financial implications. A lot of people think you just pick up and leave. No, there's buyouts, and those buyouts are often substantial. And it's like, well, the school pays it. Well, it's all coming out of the same pot. If the school pays it, that's fine, but that's less money you're getting. So essentially you're paying it. And the way it was written in my contract, you know, somehow, some way, that was going to be compensated. So the school was covered from a financial perspective. It's interesting, Doug, because I remember in the 80s, the idea was floated about tenure for college basketball coaches. You know, you're an employee of the university just like a professor is. Maybe that will curb cheating. Maybe guys will be more on the up and up. And faculty went crazy. Like, you're not faculty. You're coaches. So you're going to be treated differently. And that's fine. I get that. We are different in the faculty. But, you know, we live in a fickle world, and you could be riding high one day and not the other, and next thing you know, you've got 3, 4, 5 kids. You've got to up and move and pay your mortgage. I mean, it's nothing that anybody else doesn't deal with in whatever profession you're in. And you hope that any time you're in any position, it goes the way it did when I was at Siena, with unbelievable people, right, relationships that were maintained. All of our guys graduated. We won championships. Okay, an opportunity presented itself for me and my family, and everybody was thrilled for me.
Last thing here. What does it mean to you? I think, you know, one of the reasons that you had to go to Notre Dame was you didn't have a godfather, right? You didn't, when you're at Penn and you're at Lehigh, you didn't have a godfather who could pick up the phone and make a call for you to get you that bigger job. And you've been able to do this not solely on your own. A lot of it is relationships that you have so many of on the East Coast. But like, look, you know, you had to go take the Greensboro job and win to get the Siena job and win to get the Iowa job. What's it mean to be coaching in a place like Iowa, in a league like the Big Ten, which is an unbelievably accomplished coaches league, right? To stand there on the sidelines, and you guys have been good, and after a down year, now you're really, really good. Do you ever have time to take a deep breath in and look around and have that perspective?
That's a great question, and you know, when people say that's a great question, oftentimes it means they don't really have a great answer. I probably don't do that. You know, you're kind of living in the moment.
I know, but like, I mean, I'll just share my like, look, I have the same problem that I think a lot of coaches have, where, you know, I constantly want more, and this is like my third network, and some people don't know how to take that. You want more, right? But I'm like you, I'm a competitive guy. And every once in a while, I do have the moment where I realize, like, hey, I didn't play at Duke. I didn't play at Syracuse. I didn't play in a Final Four. And yet I've been able to carve out a very good career for myself and provide for my family, right? Whereas, you know, you didn't play at Duke. You didn't play at Carolina. You know, you didn't play at Kentucky. You didn't work for Dean Smith. You didn't work for Mike Krzyzewski. And yet you've been able to carve out an incredible career for yourself. And I just wonder if you've ever had that moment where you look around and you go, like, damn. Like, even if I don't ever reach a Final Four or a national championship, I have made it. In whatever the over-under is, you've hit the over in terms of success.
I think that's a great way to put it. I recognize every day how important Hawkeye Athletics is to the people in this state and to our alums and our fan base. So I don't ever underestimate what it means to be sitting in the chair that I'm sitting in right now. And the one thing I've always done is never looked at the next opportunity. I only try to do the job that's here. If an opportunity presents itself after the season, and maybe you can take a look at it, I don't have any intention of doing that here, but I recognize that this is important, what we're doing. It means it's important to a lot of people. But at the end of the day as well, I'm coaching another man and another woman's child. That's the most important thing. How do I treat that person? If I have a guy who's struggling in the classroom, if he's struggling with depression, if he's not playing well, I need to get him playing well. If he expected more, he's not playing as much, can we get the most out of him playing what he's playing and get total buy-in like we talked about at the start of the show? So, you know, I am excited and I am thrilled. I don't know that I do enough of what you said to say, hey, you know, this is really good because I'm grinding. Mm-hmm. But I am appreciative and thankful and recognize that, you know, when I walk out on the court and there's 15,000 people there and there's a national television audience, that's pretty cool. And when I take a recruit onto the field at Kinnick Stadium, and there's 70,000 people. You know, I brought Luca Garza in. We had 15,000 on Friday night for one of our games, 42,000 for the wrestling match on Saturday outside, and then 70,000 that night for football. That's pretty cool. And then you had a kid from Washington, D.C. to say, yeah, I'll come up and play for you. Or Tyler Cook. I mean, you always appreciate that. So it's exciting. It's exhilarating. But it's also challenging. And like I said, nerve-wracking sometimes. And you just keep grinding. And right now we're just trying to figure out how to beat Rutgers.
Awesome. I appreciate your friendship. It's been a long time.
Me
together,
too, Doug. And always great talking with you. And look forward to seeing you sometime soon. You know, hopefully before the Final Four, but if not, definitely then.
All right, man. I love you, man. Thanks so much.
Love you too, babe. Take care.
Let me give you a couple other things here. There's just so much talk about the Lakers and the proposed trade and what happens to the Lakers. Look, my people inside the Lakers have said, we weren't offering up all of our prospects and draft picks and cap room. If that was offered, then Dell Demps is a complete idiot for not taking it. Now, Dell Demps might be an idiot for not taking whatever was offered, and Dell Demps had the Lakers in some level as the only ones kind of negotiate against themselves, but there's a lot of risk there if you're Demps. A lot of risk there if you're Demps, in that the offer may not come out as strong. I mean, think about the things that have to go his way. It's one of the, I was doing the UCLA-Utah game, and Utah came from 17 down with 6 minutes to go and won the game. And Utah was down three with 8 seconds to go. UCLA fouled them with 6.9 seconds to go. And I said at the time on the broadcast, I said, hey, look, I thought they fouled too early. But they foul and Utah makes both free throws. Then Utah fouls. UCLA makes one out of two. And Van Dyke makes a three at the buzzer. And Utah pulls off the upset. And Ken Pomeroy was just like, hey, to all you people who think you always foul up three, here's what happened. Here's what can happen when you foul up three. And my point has always been, yes, it can happen. There's a percentage chance it happens. But in order to lose when you're up three and you foul under 7 seconds to go, Utah had to make both those free throws. That's not a 100% shot. UCLA had to miss a free throw. In this case, they missed one out of two free throws. And then Utah has to make the shot in order to beat you. There's these different, like, that's like four things that have to happen. And sometimes you miss you're thinking about the second free throw, you miss the first free throw. Or you miss a free throw and the wrong team gets the basketball. The point is that a bunch of things have to go in your favor if you're Utah to win the game when the team fouls. Whereas if you're down three, all you have to do is make a shot and now you're a tied game, you go to overtime. Well, the same you could be said for the Pelicans. In order for the Celtics to engage in a trade, they have to secure Kyrie Irving with a long-term deal. We don't know if that happens. And then they have to get the Celtics to decide they want to trade Jason Tatum. We don't know what that looks like at the end of the season. And even if that happens, they got Anthony Davis has to want to go there, be willing to show up, and be willing to go like, hey, I'll have an open mind to re-signing. We don't know if that happens. And then you get the Knicks. A lot of things they have to get Kevin Durant or get Kemba Walker and make Anthony Davis believe. Otherwise, he doesn't want to go there. And what do they have to send back in return? So I think that in an effort to show an effort of being petty, I think the Pelicans come out looking bad. That said, boy, Lakers need to start playing better. You'll know early on. They have a stretch there where they play the Pelicans twice and the Grizzlies once. They need to win all three of those games, need to beat the Suns, simply beat all the teams they need to beat and split with the playoff teams, and I think they'll be okay. The question is, can they get to the 7 seed to avoid the Warriors in the first round? It would be an epic series, a really interesting series, but I don't think you particularly want to play the Warriors in the first round, because that would feel like an early exit. Some of these guys, although they did beat the Warriors on Christmas Day without LeBron James, they need Lonzo Ball back because he's so good defensively, and LeBron's not as good defensively as he used to be, and Kyle Kuzma's not a good defender. Rondo's not what his reputation tells you as a defender either. And to anybody out there who says that the Celtics are better without Kyrie Irving, ask anybody in the league, look at the metrics, and oh yeah, by the way, look at the quality of opponent when he's playing. It's simply not true. If it were true, if they felt it was true, they'd move him. But the reason they're willing to move mountains to bring back Kyrie Irving to continue to recruit him when he can be a little bit of a pain in the ass is because he is, in fact, that good. All right, I hope you enjoyed the All Ball podcast, enjoyed my good friend, Fran McCaffrey. I thought that was a really interesting tale. We got great stuff for you upcoming. Make sure you download, rate, and subscribe, and tell a friend about this pod, because we talk all ball all the time. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.